the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Chris Collins, who is Associate Director of the Office of Financial Aid and Scholarships at San Diego State University. And you might have guessed from our guest this week what the topic is here on Lifetime Income. It's that time of year when students don cap and gown. It's time for graduation, but some of them may even be going on to graduate school. Now, for parents dealing with the reality of education, may be rather impactful as they first began to look at it. Remember, it's not only college students that are graduating, it's also high school students graduating and looking towards college. If you're in a state of shock looking at the bill, well, misery likes company. You're not alone. Between 2014 and 2015, for private institutions, tuition and fees are up 3.6%. That includes tuition fees, room and board. The average cost for a private tuition is $42,419. The state average, if you're an in-state, you're going to a college in your state, it's an average of $18,943, up 3% over last year. So today we're going to cover the cost of college, how to plan for it, to save for it, what your choices and options are, and maybe why you want to rethink your college plan. So Jim and I are going to discuss your options, and Jim will be interviewing Chris Collins later on.
You know something, John, when you talk about sending a kid to college today, it's often probably one of the largest expenses a family will incur. In fact, it's, you know, really, when you think about it, it's right up there with buying a house. In fact, depending on the number of kids that you have, or let's say the college they attend, it may cost more than your house. And for most families, the number that matters most is how much will they spend out of the pocket. And let me run some numbers by you just to put this into perspective. According to a recent study published by the U.S. Department of Education and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, John, family spending for education accounts for about 45% of cost. Federal loans make up about 21%, federal and state grants about 12%, scholarships about 12%, and 11% in other forms of benefits. So as you can see, families are really flipping half the cost of a bill. And as John had mentioned previously, the average cost on a individual private college has gone up to over $42,000. It's over $18,000 for in-state. So depending on whether you're going to private school, out-of-state school, or a public school, the cost can be substantial depending on, of course, college chosen and really the number of kids, but it can mount up. And unfortunately, John, as you well know, and as I know, any parent that has kids, usually those expenses hit you right around your late 40s, early 50s, right when you really should be salting away as much as you can for your retirement. And wham, here comes junior number one, then junior number two, and then there's Sally. And all of a sudden, it's just year after year, and you know those costs can add up.
Yeah, you're right. This is where it's a double whammy where it comes together. And oftentimes when we discuss retirement plans here, that's when the issue of education does come up, because you basically have to manage education and retirement simultaneously. And they're making a big demand on you. And if you hadn't started thinking of that when your kids were younger, then you could find yourself in some kind of a straits here. And when this all comes together, given just the norms of averages about when people get married, when they have children, when they start going to college, this happens when the parents are in their late 40s and early 50s and into denial about the fact they're getting older. But we won't deal with that today on this show. This is a time when they really need to be socking it away, you know, substantial sums for retirement when they're having to shell it out for educational expenses.
And here's the real issue that really comes into, and we run into this so many times when we're doing retirement plans, especially those planning for retirement, John, is there's a trade-off between education and retirement. I mean, you know, if we all had Einsteins as kids, of course, we'd want them all to go to Harvard, Stanford, MIT. And the trade-off is a secure retirement versus, let's say, the best education that money can buy. And one mistake that we see so often parents sacrificing their own retirement for their kids' education. And maybe, John, one of the worst mistakes that I've seen parents do, which is really go into debt. So they take out a second on a home, they refinance their house, taking out equity to pay for that college. And here's the problem. As you mentioned, this may be hitting you at the end of the 40s. Maybe you're in your early 50s. You're 15 years away from retirement, and you're going to have to pay off those education loans if you're taking out a home equity loan, or let's say taking equity out of your house through a refinancing, versus let's say junior who's got 40 years ahead of him in his working career to pay down those loans. So, you know, fortunately, there are really a lot more better options. And hopefully, as we go through today, we're going to help you realize this too, that the education system is changing. We're seeing more universities come up with online programs. We're seeing more students opt for working part-time and going to school online. We're seeing partnerships with, let's say, major corporations and junior colleges, very much like the guilds that they had in the 14th century, where they come up with maybe a two-year certification program that leads to either a manufacturing job, a technology job, or a medical science job, versus, let's say, getting a general education, graduating from college with a lot of student debt and not a lot of job opportunities.
Okay, so you talk about better choices. Now, what do you usually recommend? Because I would imagine, as you say, these can be some rather difficult decisions, especially if junior is an up-and-coming Einstein. I always like the way my youngest, who's just about to get a PhD in chemistry, kept announcing to me changes in his plans. You know, guess what? I'm getting a second bachelor's degree in mathematics. Guess what, Dad? You know, these are what I call BTWs. Oh, by the way, and then I'd have to go, oh, groan. So I finally began running up a tab for him, and I keep a running tab on the debts here, you know, for the excess and everything, saying, and when you get that $500,000 a year job, you will repay me.
The one I love, a client was relating to me that, you know, it started out as an out-of-state four-year degree that's now in year six. apparently, junior met the love of his life and decided, you know, to do a little surfing, maybe take a semester off. Here we are in year six, and we still haven't gotten a bachelor's degree. I haven't heard the latest. Hopefully, he graduates this year.
That part's really bad. In this case, it was all constructive. You know, it was just that it didn't go the way it was planned. So if you haven't been through it, you can only imagine what it's like for these families right now, especially if you have two, three, or four children to put through college. Now, without getting totally overwhelmed, like, we'll never be able to do this, what would you recommend?
You know, for most families, and we're using this strategy more and more, I call it my 2+2 program. And that's really 2 years at a junior college and 2 years at a state school. Now, if you're going to go to a junior college, that could run $2,000 to $3,000 a year. So 2 years at a junior college, let's just round it off at $3,000. There's $6,000, $18,000 at an in-state college. That would be a public. That's $18,000. So you're talking about 36 plus 6. You're roughly $50,000 and under. And I also recommend a work and aid program. There's nothing wrong, folks, with junior working part-time to help defray some of the cost. But more importantly, $50,000 to fund for is certainly a lot more reasonable education plan than trying to fund, as you mentioned, John, at the start of this program, the average nationwide for a private education is over $42,000. Multiply that times four, you know, you're almost $170,000 for a private education. $50,000 is certainly a lot more workable versus, let's say, $170,000 or $200,000, depending on where you're going to. And by the way, folks, I mean, I went to junior college. You'll love this. John, we're really going to be dating ourselves. My tuition, I went to Phoenix College. It was $45 a semester. I got my two-year degree for $180. Of course, that didn't count the books, but I was working my way through school. And then after that, I went on to Arizona State University. And when I graduated, my degree didn't say one half an Arizona State University. It said, you know, bachelor's degree, Arizona State University. And it was so much cheaper because I had to work my way through school. So, you know, we came from a large family, didn't have the money to pay all of those bills. And many of you listening to this program, you may be in a similar situation. Maybe you have two kids, three, four kids, or even more. How are you going to put 4, 5, 6 kids through school today? You know, it's bad enough that state school cost over $18,000. Imagine private school at over $40,000.
Yeah, the work option is something that I know worked for me, because what I did is I went to college during the day and then I worked for a classical radio station at night. So, you know, classical pieces run 20, 30 minutes. So between Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, you know, you could get some reading and some studying done. So that was something that just worked out. And the radio station was closed down at night, except for the guy who was running it, which was yours truly. And so it tended to work out. So that's a possibility. Now, I know one of the other areas too, you know, you talked about Junior wanted to take some time off and go surfing and this and that. What about not immediately going to college? Explain this one.
You know, this is something that I'm also in favor, and especially if you have, let's say, a son or daughter, and they really don't know what to do. You know, I know a family where their son was a valedictorian of his high school graduating class. And anybody that's a valedictorian, I mean, you can pretty much write your ticket to a Ivy League school, get in, you know, Stanford, Harvard. But this particular individual didn't really know what he wanted to do. And how many times have you seen this? You know, I'm going to tell a little story. I mean, you know, when I went to college, it was like, okay, where are the big bucks? It's doctors and law. I quickly found out with chemistry classes and biology classes, nah, I'm not going to be a doctor. And, you know, at one time I thought about law school, but then I found out, oh my goodness, it's not just 4 years of college, it's 3 years of law school. That's 7 years. Ended up going to graduate school anyway, but nonetheless, I changed my major a couple of times, and when I went on to graduate school, thank goodness, I wanted to go work in the State Department, and I went to an international school and got a business degree. And, you know, I spoke a foreign language, got all of these things, and I had so many more options, but it wasn't until later on, and really, it was my senior year that I really came to the conclusion, hey, this is where I want to go. So a lot of times today, kids, you know, they graduate from high school, they really don't know what they want to do. Does it make sense? What's wrong with going to work? I know in our situation with our own kids, my middle son wanted to be a veterinarian. And what he did is during the summer months in high school, he worked for a veterinarian. After a couple of years, he decided, no, I really didn't want to do that. And so then he thought about biochemistry and he worked in Pfizer's research lab. And so a lot of times by working, you may find out, hey, this is something I really enjoy. I really like this. So unless you have a kid that, you know, is basically, you know, dad, I'm going to be a doctor. Dad, I'm going to be an attorney, or I'm going to be a scientist with a definite goal in mind. There's nothing wrong with working or taking some time off. It can not only be financially rewarding, but also be directive as well. It was my son's 2 summers working at a vet's office, let's not mention getting bit a number of times by dogs, that said, I don't think I'm cut out for this. He loves animals. But anyway, you know, there's nothing wrong with working. And one of the things that, John, we're seeing a trend in, we're seeing a trend not only towards more online education, cooperatives between businesses and local junior colleges with certificate programs, but we're seeing more and more students, especially in the millennial generation, that are opting to stay at home and live with mom and dad because they're saying, you know what, I don't want to go out on my own, get my own place, run all this debt for college and room and board, and then, you know, get out of college and I've got $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth of loans, especially if mom and dad can't pay for everything. And so I think this is going to be a new trend that we're going to see, this 2+2 program I talked about, working out of high school or maybe working part-time, going to school and maybe going to online courses at night. We're seeing this more and more. And not only that, also in the working field, a lot of people that have full-time jobs and families today, a lot of companies will sponsor, let's say, an MBA program or a master's program. My own daughter-in-law is an engineer, and her company sponsored and sent her through getting her master's degree in engineering management at the same time she was working. She was doing that a couple nights a week online. So the course of traditional education, junior goes to high school, graduates and goes straight to college, John, I think that's changing with the new realities of the job workplace and also the cost of education itself.
You know, besides, a good case of rabies always helps your college career, right?
Well, you never got rabies, but getting bit a few times, that happened quite frequently.
I'm sure.
Nothing like a pit bull.
So 2+2 makes college savings more reasonable is what it is. You know, but the work option is good. I did that and it did work. Now, I didn't have to do that for my kids generally. We were able to structure things in such a way to let them really concentrate on their studies because they pretty well, for the most part, knew where they wanted to go when they got into it. But as you said, some don't. And I didn't for, well, I always wanted to be in broadcasting, but, you know, it sort of wobbled around there for a little while. Now, one of the issues that students face today are the enormous debt loads that they're having upon graduation. We hear some of these as being $100,000. Basically, Jim, they're paying off a good part of a house, so to speak, in college loans, and they're just starting out. And a lot of times people, when you're starting out, especially if it's a profession, you may not make terrific amounts of money to start with. That will happen over time. So they're already facing a challenge because theoretically they're going to try to buy a home or something like that and start a family at the same time.
Yeah, one of the statistics they found out in this housing recovery coming out of the Great Recession is first-time home buyers dropped dramatically. And one of the reasons behind it is a lot of new starting families were starting their life as a married couple with $70,000 of debt. If they went to private school, it's probably over $100,000. According to the Wall Street Journal this week, the average student debt is $27,300. In fact, the average young couple, as I mentioned, probably between $70,000 and $100,000. So making college costs reasonable, the 2+2 plan that we talked about that we often recommend to a lot of our clients or working part-time during college can often not only reduce the cost, but help your children start out life not by being in debt. So imagine getting married, both husband and wife, both have jobs, good paying jobs with no student loans, not to mention make life easier financially for mom and dad. So I think this whole education paradigm, John, as a result of cost, what is it over the last couple decades? Education has been going up at almost 6 to 8% a year, you know, almost 2 to 3 times the national inflation rate. And, you know, add 2 or 3 decades and here we are. $42,000 for a private education and over $18,000 for a state education.
Well, I know you're going to be discussing this with your guest, Chris Collins, today. What about student loans, grants, scholarships, and other educational funding? Now, in the case of my youngest, who's in graduate school now, we've made the whole thing self-funding. In other words, he is actually picking up enough money to support him and to get him through his tuition, so we don't have to put any more into the pot.
Well, in just a moment, we're going to be talking with the college financial aid officer, and we'll get more into the aid programs, grants, scholarships, etc. I mean, there's a myriad programs out there from loans to grants to scholarships. In fact, something you're going to want to get, the U.S. Education Department and the Consumer Financial Protection Agency released something called a financial aid shopping list. And really what this is, a template for schools to adopt for aid letters that they send to you. The sheet calls for schools to provide estimated cost of attendance and the total of grants and scholarship and arrive at really the number that you want to know as a parent. What's the net out of cost pocket to you? What are you going to have to pay? And there are a number of things that you want to be aware of. I'm just going to cover these briefly. Number one, the cost of attendance. This is really, folks, the total sticker price. This includes tuition, fees, books, supplies, room and board, transportation expenses. Unfortunately, not all schools spell out the total cost of attendance, and even those that do may not account for each component. For example, they may leave out, for example, the cost of books. And John, have you seen some of the cost of these textbooks are over $100? And, you know, room and board. And you can find your school's total cost of attendance. There's a website. It's nces.ed.gov/collegenavigator. If you can look at that, it'll tell your school's total cost of attendance. You really need to know that. We have these figures in a database in our financial planning software. Now, here's another one you need to know. It's called the net cost of attendance. Now, here's the real number you want to know, because it's net tuition. How much families are expected to pay after taking grants, loans, and other student aid into account? Now, not all colleges include the net cost of college on the award letters, but that's slowly changing. About 2,900 schools have adopted the government's easy-to-read financial aid award letter, which lists not only the tuition front and center, but you can still figure out the net tuition by adding up all of your grants and scholarships and subtracting them from the total cost of attendance. Now, here's another thing you need to be aware of when you're looking at those letters. Money that's free. These are grants. The best thing about grants is they don't have to be paid back. It's free money that's yours, so as long as you put it toward your total cost of attendance. The amount of the grants you qualify obviously depends on your family's financial need. Scholarships. You don't have to pay those back. Your school will notify you in the award letter. Now, here's another thing that we're starting to see, and that is money you have to work for. Federal student loans. Student loans could be bundled together with grants, scholarships under the financial aid banner. But don't be mistaken, loans must be repaid eventually, beginning usually 6 months after their graduation date. Then you also have what is called unsubsidized loans versus subsidized loans. Depending on your year in school, you can take out $5,500 to $12,500 in direct subsidized loans and direct unsubsidized loans. And then there's also something called work study. If you indicated your interest in the federal work study program when you filled out your FAFSA form, you'll find out if you qualify on your financial aid award letter. Work study eligibility depends on your family's income and household size. So there's a number of things that you can get here that can help defray some of the cost, but you do want to get to understand those terms when you're looking at these financial awards or these letters that they send to you. So you really need to understand the terms and understand really what is the number that's out of pocket for myself.
Well, there are obviously a lot of options here. So now, how do you make parents, who are obviously your clients, by the way, make these decisions? There are a lot of factors. There's the 2+2 idea, in-state, out-of-state, private, public school, junior college, plus full 4 year afterwards. There must be a structuring plan.
Well, usually this is part of the financial planning process. I mean, you have to take a look at what your income is, your ability to save, your number of years for retirement, and you also have to take a look at the education cost. Now, we have software. It's based as of the end of 2014, so we can tell you your all-in cost for attending, whether it's a junior college, state college, or private cost. So it gives you a pretty good idea of what the education costs are going to be. And then really, John, it gets down to working with a budget. And it's a matter of making life choices. There are going to be some trade-offs. You know, what parent wouldn't want to send their kid to Harvard, Stanford, MIT, Brown, Georgetown, all the prominent Ivy League schools? But it's a matter of what can you afford? What aid is available? Scholarships, grants, work programs. And especially if you have more than one kid that's going to go to college, it depends on really what fits into the budget. And like all decisions we make in life, there's trade-offs between your own retirement, security, and the education of your children.
If you had to pick off your best advice that listeners should have based on experience, is there a given set of rules or a path that they can follow very firmly?
Well, I mean, just like we have told so many that have listened to these programs on lifetime income, the earlier you start, the better. So let's take my 2+2 program, 2 years at a junior college, 2 years at a state school, which runs anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000. Let's say parents are now having a newborn child. That child has 18 years from the time it's born to the time it'll probably enter college. If you would like to save for, let's say, $50,000 at the time that child turns 18, have that money there, it would cost you roughly, I'm assuming a 6 to 8% return, roughly about $100 a month. Wait 10 years. Now there's only 8 years away from college. It's going to cost you four times as much, $400 a month. And also don't forget, when you're looking at these plans, I'm a big believer in working. In fact, in the future, we may see the rise of work and online education as a path to a higher education versus, you know, you get out of school and you go directly to college. We've done a number of programs, not only in Lifetime, but also on the weekend program in terms of mega trends. One of the big trends that we're seeing is almost like the guilds that we had in the 14th century are specialty programs that companies are working with junior colleges. And we're seeing this take place in manufacturing and the medical arena and technology, with the prospect after 2 years at a junior college, you get certified, you have an immediate job, because employers, especially in manufacturing, are looking for qualified workers. There's a shortage in medical and, of course, in technology. And also, you know, one of the great things about working, you may find out what you really like to do, the field. I'd mentioned in the case of my son where he found out that, you know, he didn't really want to be a vet, and he ended up in the financial industry in the long run. But, you know, you may end up changing your field of work or study as a result of work. More importantly, as a result of work, you may graduate debt-free. Think about that. Getting out of school, no debt, no student loans to pay off. So that when you do get married, you start saving, you can get that dream home that you'd like to have, or take the vacations you would like to have, or more importantly, start saving early for retirement so that you will have the secure retirement you always look forward to.
Okay, so one thing is to start early and then to have realistic goals, sort of like a 2+2 approach. Now, what about savings vehicles, trying to save up money that can actually earn money while you're saving toward the college education?
Well, I mean, so much depends on your financial objectives. For example, the type of program, undergraduate programs in college, state school, private school, graduate school, and also specialty school. Let's not forget, you know, and your son, he's getting his PhD. Think of people that go on to medical school, dental school, graduate business, or even law school. How many years of schooling? You know, most parents are planning for a 4-year, and then all of a sudden you get the surprise. Hey, mom, dad, did I ever tell you about that MBA program? Or how about, you know, I really like biology. I want to go to med school. So, and then, of course, the major difference between public and private education. So much of that, you really need to understand and set some realistic goals and say, you know what, I've had parents where we've done plans and I've had to come out and say, there's no way you're going to be able to afford to put those three kids through private school. It's just not there. Or you'll be working to the day you're 90. It just isn't achievable. So you really need to know what you're funding for. And the longer that you have to fund, the sooner that you start, you know, it favors the stock market as an investment. If you're putting money in monthly, like you have a monthly savings program, it could be a 529 plan, which we'll talk about in a second here. It could be invested in a stock mutual fund. And quite honestly, if you're putting money into a stock mutual fund when, you know, Junior is born, do you really care what Janet Yellen is saying now? Who knows who the chairman of the Fed is going to be 18 years from now? But we do know that stocks over the long run offer better returns than, let's say, a bank account or bonds. So I prefer stock or stock mutual funds, especially when starting early to fund a college education.
All right. Now, how do taxes factor into this? It's a combination of aid and or taxes.
Well, I mean, there are a number of tax breaks for education. There's something called the Hope Scholarship Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. These are deductions you can take above the line on the tax return. Student loan interest is a federal tax income deduction, and there's deductions for higher education expenses. So those things, you can use those. And there's also what we call the 529 plan. These are plans, if used, and folks, if you're a grandparent, you're thinking, you know, you have a favorite grandson or granddaughter, graduation's coming up, or maybe you're having your first grandchildren, and you really want to think about, what's something I can do for my grandkids? They'll always remember, and it'll be something that I'll be proud that I did. You might want to talk to your children about setting up a 529 plan. These are plans, if used exclusively for education, all the gains, capital gains, interest and dividends are tax deferred. And when you cash it in, if used for a college education, it's tax free. I know there was some controversy in the State of the Union because President Obama wanted to get rid of the tax free status when you cashed in, but there was too much of an outpouring against that. So right now, the 529 plans are one of the best ways to save for that, because not only is the interest and dividends tax deferred, a lot of times when you make gifts to minors, once minors have a certain level of income, I forget what the threshold is, it's usually around $1,500 or more, Anything over that, it's taxed at the parent's higher tax bracket. So 529 plans make much more sense because not only is it tax deferred, but it's tax free upon retirement. And there's things such as education IRAs. You know, maybe we'll do a subsequent program to this on the various tax planning ramifications for education, but there's just not enough time in today's program to cover that.
Finally, Jim, we were going to talk about what it is college grads could do, some advice for them. I think the first thing would be pay your old man back for all the money he fronted you.
Dad wants to retire. You owe him some big bucks.
You owe me some bucks out of this stuff. After all, they're just starting out their careers. What should they do? And they're having to plan their lives and the very same thing all over again. You know, so I think some kind of a roadmap would help them make better financial choices.
You know, unless you majored in financial planning, finance, or business, the number one advice if you're graduating from school is take on debt sparingly. And if you're taking on debt, use it for an asset. The purchase of a home is a good example of that, or buying an automobile. Even though autos are depreciating assets, you need them. You have to get to work. So using debt sparingly, and mainly using it for assets, as I mentioned, a home and auto are very good examples. Going into debt to take a vacation, going into debt to buy a whole bunch of toys, bad, bad advice. So number one, take on debt sparingly. Number two, start saving. We've given examples. If you wanted to have $1 million at the time you retire, you could do that investing in stocks over the long run, over a 40-year working career. You know, it's probably closer to $100, $150, or half that if you work in a company that, let's say, has matching contributions in your 401k. You put in a dollar, the company puts in a dollar. Well, guess what? You just made 100% on your dollar contribution. So it could be $150 or $75 a month starting out. 40 years from now, you could have $1 million. And quite honestly, and I recommend, when you're starting out, invest in the stock market. If you're using mutual funds through your 401k program, what are you doing? You're dollar cost averaging. So if the stock market corrects 10% this month, guess what? The money you put in is buying more shares at a lower price. And all you care about really 40 years from now is how many shares you have. What's the value of those shares? So invest appropriately. I see so many young kids say they're starting out their savings program in 401ks and they're invested in bonds, they're in cash, instead of being in the stock market. Number four, live within your means. Have a budget. And by doing so, by having a budget, living within your means, you're going to have the money to have that down payment on a home. You're going to have the money put aside for that college education for your kids. And you're going to have the money longer term for your retirement 40 years from now. And finally, never stop learning. Because technology is hitting us at such a rapid pace. I was in a conference in Vegas, and I heard a statistic by one of the keynote speakers, and it really stunned me when he said this. The average S&P company in 1920 had a lifespan of 67 years. The average S&P company today has a lifespan of only 20 years. And listen to this one, 40% of the companies in the S&P 500 will not exist 10 years from now. Now think about that. So the value of educating yourself, never stop learning. It's good for your brain, and especially if you're in retirement, it helps keep you healthy. It helps avoid things like dementia or Alzheimer's. It keeps you healthy, and it'll keep you financially secure.
Time for our case study. Our case studies are based on real life actualities with which we have been involved, but the names are changed to protect the privacy of the individuals involved. This will illustrate the issues that parents have. In this case, we have a bright daughter who was accepted to a top private school where the costs were well beyond what the parents could afford. So, Jim, let's discuss the case of Joe and Kathy Simpson and their daughter, Jennifer.
Yeah, I wanted to discuss this case because it illustrates a couple points that we've been talking about here, and it reflects a situation that many families find themselves today. In this case, Joe was an engineer at Qualcomm. Kathy, his wife, was a dental hygienist. This was a second marriage. Two children were from Kathy's previous marriage and one of their own. Their oldest daughter, Jennifer, had high SAT scores, 4.0, high GPA, accepted to USC, $50,000 per year. And the unfortunate thing was only $30,000 were saved up, mainly gifts from Kathy's parents. Now, Jennifer wanted to be a teacher. And, you know, folks, here in California, where teacher salaries are probably a little bit higher, 4 years, the starting salary is in the $40,000 range. I think it's somewhere around $42,000, $43,000 versus the cost of an education, $200,000. And I hate to tell you, and this also goes in terms of work in private education. If you went to, you know, USC, Harvard, Stanford, whatever it is, you're a teacher, they're not going to pay, oh, you went to Harvard? I guess instead of 43, we're going to pay you 63. It doesn't work that way. And by the way, even if you did go to Harvard, you're not going to be a teacher. You're out in the workforce. I don't know. You're in the business world. You know what? After your first job or two, after 5, 6, 8 years experience, nobody's looking at your education. They're looking at what you've done, what you've achieved, who you've worked for. And so the problem here is the Simpsons had a home, roughly about $900,000, $500,000 mortgage. Joe had about $600,000 in his 401k program, $100,000 in company stock. Kathy's 401k was roughly about $90,000. They had about $40,000 in IRAs. Their personal savings were only $20,000. Now, one of the things that they were thinking of doing was getting a second mortgage to take care of Jennifer's student loans. And what I did is we start talking about this, and I'm saying, folks, number one, in terms of their education and their own retirement, they were only, in the case of Joe, was 12 years away from retiring. Kathy was probably closer to 15 years. So they didn't have enough money to live the lifestyle and achieve their retirement goals. That was number one. Number two, if they were going to take out a second mortgage to pay for this education, that was going to set them back further. It was going to raise their monthly living expenses, which means less money saved for retirement. And I talked to him about the 2+2 program, 2 years at a junior college, 2 years at a state school, because basically, you know what? Jennifer wasn't going to get paid any more by going to a private college that would cost $200,000.
Okay, so those were the options. What happened?
You know, they opted for the 2+2 program because we managed to convince them that taking out $150,000 line of credit on their home wasn't in their best interest. They already had $500,000 mortgage on it. And, you know, in Joe's case, he was 12 years away before he retired, and they didn't have enough to reach their retirement goals. And that was the hard part. And I actually met with their daughter, and I explained, I said, look, you know, you're starting out here. This is a $200,000 education. You're going to start out at $40,000 a year. Do you really want to saddle your parents with this debt and what that would mean for her parents? And so, you know, once that was explained, I also told her too, and I said, you know, another option you could do is you could go out and get student loans. Do you really want to start your job out of college with $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 of debt? I go, you know, just think about that. Just think of you're out there dating, trying to find a husband, and you tell your husband, oh, by the way, besides my car loan, I have $100,000, $150,000 worth of student loans. Good luck with that one. So basically, they opted for the 2+2 program, and it's working great. And it'll be certainly the amount of money that's saved. They had $30,000 saved up already, and the parents, Kathy's parents, were going to kick in the balance. And so the thing that Jennifer thought about is, hey, I start out teaching, and I have no debt. And that really convincing her that she would not have any debt, because I convinced her parents couldn't afford to take out a second mortgage and pay for her education. And secondly, the other choice was she take on that debt, and she wasn't keen on starting college, especially a teacher, with over six figures of debt starting out life. So in the end, John, I think this was a happy ending. It was a workable plan. It fit with both Joe and Kathy's retirement plans. And you know what? Kathy's going to get a great education by going to a junior college and a state school. It'll be a lot less. And more importantly, when she graduates, she's not going to be one of those statistics having $27,000 in debt. She'll be debt-free.
So the key here is, number one, start early on your planning for your kids' college education. You might stop by on the way home from the hospital and open the right kind of an investment account for them. Which brings us to point number two, make the right investments. Number three, tax minimization and optimization in terms of what you can do for education. Number four, cash flow versus your cost. And number five, consider that working while you're in college or the online option, there is more than one route or combinations of these, Jim. This is important to understand, too. You can make your own plan as you go, as long as you know all of the different components that you could possibly use. And now coming up next from San Diego State University, Chris Collins talking about, well, you might have guessed it, financing options available for students as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, it's that time of the year when students will be donning on cap and gown. It's graduation time. If you're graduating from high school, well, some big decisions coming up ahead. What college will you be going to? What will be the cost? And how will those costs be financed? Joining me on the program is Chris Collins. He's Associate Director of Office of Financial Aid and Scholarships at San Diego State University. You know, Chris, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that I found rather fascinating. It was talking about college financial aid. And according to the Wall Street Journal, 45% of tuition is paid by families, 21% by federal loans, 12% by federal and state grants, and about 12% by scholarships. As parents contemplate the cost of a college education, what kinds of grants, aids, and various forms of financing are available to them? I wonder if we could cover that, please.
I'd be glad to, Jim. When families apply for financial aid, they use the standard application, that's the free application for federal student aid or FAFSA. And by submitting just that one application, they're applying for federal aid in the form of grants, loans, work study. They're also applying for state aid in the form of Cal grants in California. And then they're also applying for institutional aid, aid administered directly by the California State University. And that can be in the form of a state university grant or an educational opportunity program grant. And it all depends on the family's financial circumstances and how they've filled out the application in order for a financial aid office to determine their eligibility for each of those kinds of programs.
Now, are a lot of these things based on, let's say, the net worth of the parents, the income of the parents, or, let's say, the assets of the kids?
Well, it's based on all of those factors. It's based on if a student is dependent, and most incoming freshman students are. The financial aid award, if you will, is based on the income of the parent and then the assets, if there are any, but that excludes home value. And then the student's income and student's assets, if any, are also used to calculate what is called an expected family contribution, or EFC. And that's the figure that's used to determine how much need an individual has in order for a financial aid office to package them with the various loans, grants, and work study awards.
Chris, is there a certain level of income that kind of stands out that if, let's say, a parent has a certain level of income, there's less chance of aid? Just as we know, for example, today, based on certain levels of income, you are paying certain amounts of tax. Does the same thing work when it comes to financial aid, that a certain level of income, you're unlikely to get any help, or maybe the help that you do get is less, or maybe it's a certain kind, you might be able to get a loan, but maybe not a grant or a work study?
That's a common belief, that there is like a cutoff or a threshold, if you will, at which above the amount of income a family would not be eligible. But it really works more on a sliding scale, and it takes into account a lot of different variables. So we can't say with any degree of certainty that a family of four with one family member in college that's making $50,000 will or won't qualify for grant because there's other variables that are included in the picture. We also have to look at the asset, and we also have to look at other factors. But to qualify for federal grants like the Pell Grant or the Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, typically families have to have low income, and I'd say probably less than $30,000. But that's not to say that families with incomes greater than $30,000 cannot qualify for those grants and programs. It just depends on other factors like the family size, the number of family members that are attending college. Some families that have maybe not a high income have a lot of assets, and the assets can make them ineligible for federal or state or institutional grants.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when it comes to a family, let's say you have a husband and wife, they're making six figures a year, let's say over $100,000. On the surface, it looks like a lot of income, but let's say they have three children, all of college age, and let's say two of them are in college at the same time. Does anything like that, like the number of kids that are attending college? Because certainly if you had two or three kids in college at the same time, that's very expensive.
Absolutely. And the federal formula, the methodology, does take into account the fact that there are multiple family members in college. And it makes the determination of how much of a family contribution for each student is based on the number of members. Because, as you just said, it's understood that they're going to be paying college expenses for not one student, but college expenses for two and maybe more students. So the methodology accounts for that. It lowers the expected family contribution and presumably allows for that to be taken into consideration when the family is applying for aid and qualifying for grants or loans or work study.
How much do things like grades, grade point average, test scores play when it comes to getting some kind of financial aid? So let's say that I have a parent in, you know, maybe we've got a couple kids, we're making six figures, but Junior is the next Einstein.
Most of the financial aid that we administer doesn't take into account grade point average or test scores or things of that nature. The one exception is the Cal Grant program, which will pay the tuition and fees for a California resident student going to a California school. They have an entitlement program that if the student coming out of high school has a 3.0 GPA and they meet the other income qualifications, they're entitled to receive a Cal Grant. But really, other than that, the Pell Grant program has no such academic merit measurement. Really, it gets into scholarships when you're talking about academic merit and the capabilities of the student. And students can find a lot of dollars in scholarship programs, be they at San Diego State, our institutional scholarships that we administer, or other scholarships external to the university that they find from community organizations or churches or things of that nature, scholarships that they bring with them. In those cases, of course, academic merit is a very important component part of making the determination of eligibility.
When you're looking at things, or let's say a parent is applying for a grant, are there certain things that would make the likelihood of getting a grant or a scholarship less likely? You mentioned something that you look at the income. You also look at assets, because this is very important. A lot of times, when parents are trying to save for college education, sometimes they do it themselves. In other words, the parents are saving in their name. Other times, they're putting it in the names of their children. If the children have large assets, does that create a disadvantage if it comes to getting aid?
It does. Actually, the percentages work as a disadvantage in the circumstance that you just described. It's better for assets to be in the parent's name because the percentage of contribution that needs to come from those assets is lower than if the assets are in the student name. The federal methodology assumes that if there's assets in the student's name, they're more readily available for direct college expenses.
Let's take a situation that, let's say, the cost of an education, room and board for, let's say, a state school is somewhere around a little over $18,000. So let's take a student that has maybe $40,000 in their name. It's maybe in a 529 plan or something like that. So there's enough money there to pay for, let's say, a two-year degree. Does the student have to go through that money first before they could qualify for any grants or anything like that? Because I would imagine as you're allocating money as a financial aid officer, you've got to look at that and say, well, they've got 40 grand. This other student I'm looking at has nothing.
That's absolutely right. Yes. And in that case that you described, those assets would be considered available, and the percentage of the assets that are considered available, it's understood that a student may not use those assets all in 1 year because there's going to be multiple years. You said you could go for a two-year degree, an associate degree, or you could be seeking a baccalaureate degree. And those assets have to last, presumably, through the end of the student's college career, or hopefully that's the planning that's gone into that. But the student in the first circumstance that has $40,000 in a 529 plan or in other kinds of financial instruments that are liquid and available to make educational expenses or meet those costs, that student will have those assets calculated as part of the contribution that the family can make toward the total cost.
Something I'd like you to clarify for our listeners, Chris, is a lot of times there is a financial aid letter that is sent to the parents, and there are a number of terms associated with that letter. There is cost of attendance, there's net cost of attendance, there are things that are free, as we talked about, grants and scholarships, and then there's money you have to work for example, federal student loans, unsubsidized, subsidized loans, and work study. Could we go over some of these so that as these forms are sent out to parents, they might have a greater understanding of them? And I'd like to begin with cost of attendance.
Certainly. That's a critical factor in determining financial aid eligibility. The cost of attendance, there are various categories that can be included as component parts of the cost of attendance, which is dictated by the Higher Education Act. And the cost of attendance typically includes tuition and fees, housing and meals, books and supplies, transportation, and other miscellaneous expenses. And so when you look at a college website or an award letter or a portal, they should have a total cost of attendance, but it should be made up of those component parts, and you should have access to those specific individual pieces of information to know what will it cost for the tuition and fees, what will my housing cost. And those factors, the housing, for example, are dependent upon where the individual lives, of course. And we have three categories at San Diego State University, and I think most colleges use these three categories. One is what we call a commuter student living with their parents, and they'll, of course, have a lower food and housing cost. And then there's students who are living in the residence halls on campus, and then there's also those students that we call living off campus. So they're not living with their parents, they're not living in a residence hall, they're living in an apartment adjacent to the campus or in some other community. So those are the critical parts that go into cost of attendance, and every institution should be providing that information to students who have applied for financial aid so that they can look and compare and make a decision based on those numbers.
Let's go next to another figure that's on that financial aid letter. It's called the net cost of attendance. Isn't this really the number that parents really need to be concerned about? Because if they're applying for aid, isn't this sort of the nut that they have to come up with?
Yes. And I think what you're talking about is net cost. Now, net cost may not always show up on a campus's award letter, and that's why it might be confusing to compare award letters from different kinds of campuses. But the shopping sheet that many campuses have adopted does include a category that's called net cost, and that is exactly as you described. It's that estimated cost of attendance with those five categories minus grants and scholarships, the free aid that the student is receiving, to give you the sum, which is the net cost or the out-of-pocket cost for the family. And typically, that's what they'll be most concerned about. They won't care about the sticker price if it's higher, if one campus is higher than another campus, if their net costs are lower because one of the campuses was able to provide more institutional aid or scholarship aid or other kinds of gift aid that doesn't require a loan being borrowed or a work-study award.
That's a real key point here, because let's say you're applying to two or three colleges. One college has a higher room and board tuition fee, but the net cost as a result of, let's say, grants, work study, or other things that bring that cost down, it's really this net cost that is really the comparable number you want to look at.
That's exactly right. And I think people, over the last few years, there's been a lot of talk about the sticker price of colleges and that the cost continues to go up and that we exceeded the threshold of $50,000 of tuition and fees at some private institutions a couple of years ago. But that's really not the most important part. For the family, they want to know, so if the total cost of the institution is $60,000, but I only have $10,000 in out-of-pocket costs, then that's going to be a more advantageous situation for me than if I'm applying to a campus that has total costs of $40,000, but my net cost is $20,000 in that second situation. So it really is the comparison of the net cost, one to the other, which is going to be, and that's the out-of-pocket cost for the family. And there's different ways to meet that out-of-pocket cost. It's not that they have to write a check, of course. There's loans that can be borrowed. There's work study that can be earned. Students find jobs on campus and off campus that are not federal work study awards, but they're just part-time jobs that they're working either on the campus or in the community. So yes, that net cost figure. And if you have two or more campuses that you're comparing and those campuses use the shopping sheet, then that comparison is very simple because every one of the shopping sheets will have the net cost. So if you applied to six campuses, you can look at the shopping sheet for all six campuses and you can see the net cost in each one and then the option to pay the net cost.
Let's talk next about two forms of money, money that's free, such as grants and scholarships, and the other type of money, the type of money you have to work for, which could be federal student loans, subsidized or unsubsidized loans, or work study.
Yes, and that's a key part. And when we talk to parents, they're, as you might imagine, always interested in the free money, the gift aid. They're less interested, and in many cases, when I talk to parents, their award may consist entirely of loans, for example. And they say, well, you didn't make an award of any financial aid to me. And we say, yes, we did, because loans are part of the financial aid package. They are financial aid programs. But I know in the minds of parents and students, when they're thinking financial aid, they're thinking gift aid, the grant. And there's, as I mentioned at the top of the program, there's federal grants in the form of Pell Grants. That's the foundational grant, if you will, for low-income families and students. And there's also a Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant Program, another federal program. And then students can qualify for state grant programs, Cal Grant, and then they can also apply for institutional grants, state university grants. So that's the basic free money that's available at San Diego State. Now, other campuses have their own grant program, or potentially have their own grant program. So that's the gift money, and that's why the shopping sheet, I think, is a valuable tool, because it tells you, it's broken out very clearly, okay, here are the grants and scholarships that you'll be receiving. That's money that you don't have to repay. And then the next category is the net cost, so that's what will come out of pocket, and then following that is the option to pay net cost. So if you have net costs of $4,000, and then we've awarded you a $4,000 federal work study allocation, then the student has all of their cost of attendance met without borrowing any loans. And many students find that to be a very appealing situation to be in because they really want to manage their loan indebtedness so they don't get out of school with so much loan indebtedness that they find that they can't manage the payments and become delinquent or go into default.
Okay, let's talk about the money that you have to work for. And you mentioned one of them, federal student loans and the various forms of that. Talk a bit about work study. How prevalent is that? And what's the likelihood that this could be a significant factor in an aid package?
Well, it can be a significant factor in an aid package. And it's a very advantageous program for students because it allows them to work on campus. So students who are living in the residence halls, they're going to classes, they can find a job on campus, and employers tend to be more willing to hire students who have federal work study awards because they don't have to pay the full cost of the student's salary. There is a discount, and the federal government is paying part of the salary for the student. So it's good for the department to hire students who have a federal work study allocation. It's good for the student because it keeps them on campus and allows them to earn, in some cases, several thousand dollars toward their total cost of attendance. And it helps them to manage and keep their loan indebtedness down or non-existent if they're fortunate enough to put together a package of grants and work study and scholarships that is sufficient to meet their direct educational costs.
So as we take a look at all of this, talk about the shopping list. What is it? Where do you find it? Is it something specific? I think the Wall Street Journal talked about there's almost 3,000 colleges that are now using it, and the government's urging more of them to follow this protocol. Could you talk about that for a minute?
I'd be happy to. So the shopping sheet is a valuable tool to be used, and San Diego State is one of the campuses, one of the institutions that uses the shopping sheet. We've been using it for several years. And I know a lot of times when people talk about award letters, they talk about physical letters going to students, but we don't send award letters like that to students. We have what is called a portal, a financial aid portal that's password protected, where a student who's applied to the university and applied for financial aid gets assigned an institutional ID, they create a password, and then they have access to a system in which we communicate with them about the status of their financial aid application, and then ultimately any financial aid award that we make to them. So they go into the portal, they see information about their status, whether they need to provide us additional information or don't provide us with any more information. They can see the cost of attendance and all of the factors that go into determining their aid eligibility. And then there's a link on the first page that they open to the shopping sheet. And so the student will go to that link, select it, open it up, and then they can print it off. And then they can use it to compare to any other campuses that are also users of the shopping sheet. Now, I think you said 3,000 campuses. There are still some campuses out there, institutions that don't use the shopping sheet, so that makes it a little bit harder to do the comparison. Because if you're trying to compare just from the information that an institution is using, they may use different terminology. They may format an award or a cost of attendance or different pieces of information about financial aid eligibility in different ways. So what the shopping sheet does really is it organizes it in a way so you know that you're talking about the same terminology, you're talking about the same concepts, you know you're comparing net cost from campus A to campus B, and it makes it very simple. So you don't have to go and research and look at different college websites or award letters and try to make a comparison based on different terminology, different concepts, or the way the information is presented.
Chris, a final question. If you were to advise a young family, let's say a new family starting out, they've got real young kids, are there things parents can do early on when planning for education that is going to help them for college? Obviously, the sooner you start saving or putting money aside, the better off you're going to be. You have a longer period of time to compound and regular inputs into saving. Obviously, you're building a nice nest egg for your kids.
That's exactly right. And I would encourage families to start thinking about it right away. I know that young families have a lot of different financial obligations. When you live in an area like San Diego, the cost of living is expensive, so you have a lot of demands on your paycheck. But I would say that like anything else that you want to save for, be it retirement or a down payment on a home or any big expenditure that's important and that you know is going to potentially happen sometime down the road, be it 15, 18 years down the road, try saving for that in the best way that you can. Start putting away small amounts of money at the beginning. I think then when you get raises in your paycheck, you can put away larger amounts of money. Use the 529 plan because they are tax advantaged in terms of not having taxes to be collected on them when the disbursements are made and used for qualifying educational expenses. So really it is kind of the basic mantra of starting early, saving what you can, putting away a little bit now and putting away more as your salary increases and as you get in a better position to do that. And try to manage all those obligations at once. I know saving for college, saving for a down payment on a house, and saving for retirement can seem a bit daunting for young families. But I think putting away a little bit of money toward each of those areas, if those are goals of the family, gets you off on the right path. And anything that you've saved is going to be a help when you come to meeting those college expenses. I think we talk to a lot of families and their son or daughter is 18 years old and they've really done no saving whatsoever. Now, depending on what their circumstances are, they may not have been in a position to do that. But now they're thinking about it and now the cost is overwhelming in some cases and unmanageable for them. So I would say plan early, start thinking about it, start putting it away, using tax advantaged accounts if you can, and just thinking about it all along and allowing the money to compound, as you mentioned.
And in regards to applying for financial aid later on, we mentioned this earlier, would a parent be better off saving for their kid's education by keeping the funds, let's say, in their name versus putting it in the child's?
Yes. The federal methodology that is used to determine the expected family contribution always takes a greater proportion of the student's asset toward that expected family contribution than the parent's asset. And again, one of the important factors is, particularly in California and states where home equity is an issue, home equity is not considered an asset. So families who have homes and have lots of home equity don't have to worry or be concerned about that being used as part of the determining factor for the expected family contribution. But yes, assets should always be in the parent's name as opposed to the student name if that's a choice that can be made. Because the assets in the parent's name, it's understood that those need to be used for other considerations and the student can use their assets primarily for their educational costs.
And finally, Chris, is there a source, either a website or a book that you would recommend that could help guide parents planning for their kids' college education or, if for that matter, applying for financial aid?
Yes, I think there is a great website. It's called Federal Student Aid. It's the website of the Office of the U.S. Department of Education, and it has what I think is a very well-written and very well organized overview of the whole financial aid situation. And it doesn't talk just about financial aid either. It's talking about preparing for school as well, preparing for college in the respect of exploring careers. How do you choose schools? You know, what are the metrics that you would look at to choose one school over another school? So it's really a great website to get started for families where they can go and learn an awful lot of information. And then from there, they can go to, of course, when you're starting to apply to school, then you're starting to narrow your search. You're starting to figure out that, okay, well, these six campuses are the ones that I really want to consider. And maybe this one is my dream school. Maybe this next one, not so much. But that's when you can go to the individual school website. But that's not really necessary if you're doing early planning, like during high school years. Go to the Federal Student Aid website. You can learn about these concepts. So a lot of families, I think, feel rushed. They've applied for admission in the latter part of the preceding year. They're applying for financial aid beginning January 1 of the year that the student will be going to college. They're then having to make a decision by May 1st which college they're going to be attending. And I know a lot of families are kind of overwhelmed because they're looking at these concepts and ideas for the first time and they don't understand them. So it takes a little bit of time to figure out how this all works out and what is the best path to take. So I would say go to the Federal Student Aid website and learn about types of aid that are available, qualifying for aid. If you're borrowing loans, what are the terms and conditions of the loans? What are the most advantageous loans available? Those kinds of things.
Well, listen, Chris, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. It is that time of the year when we turn our attention as parents to education, and where Junior is going to be going to school. This has been very, very helpful, and I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income program. Hopefully, folks, you found this helpful, and maybe it's getting you to think a little bit different, and hopefully may offer you more options to think about when you're planning for your children's education. If you're a grandparent, you might want to be thinking about, hey, making those gifts to 529 plans for your grandchildren, how that can help not only pay for college education, but more importantly, tax efficiency, since it's tax deferred, and when used for education, it's tax free. But also think about the work options, the 2+2 plans that we talked about, so that maybe that takes away some of the burden for some of you that are now looking at these astronomical costs of education, especially if you have more than one child or you have gifted children. So we'll be doing some further programs on this as we get more into the tax efficiency options that are available to you to help do it on a tax efficient means, where you can minimize the taxes and then pay for that education with tax-free income, which makes it even better. Well, we've run out of time, so on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.